For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is February the 4th. We are in Shmuel Beis, Perek of Gimel, chapter 13. We are now continuing with the aftermath of the episode of David and Bathsheba. We know from the story of David and Bathsheba that David is going to be punished with four of his children being either killed or hurt. The first one was the first child of David and Bathsheba, who died. And this next parak, this chapter, will introduce the other three children. Two of them are going to get hurt in this parak, in this chapter, and one of them will be down the line, the next couple of chapters after that. But all three are going to be introduced here in this chapter. They are Amnon, Tamar, and Avshalom. Amnon is David's oldest son, and Avshalom is, if I remember correctly, his fourth. I can't remember if it's his third or fourth. I think it's third, actually. Hold on a second. I'll tell you for sure. Amnon is the first, and Avshalom is the third. It's different wives. But Amnon is the oldest son, born to Ahinoam. And Avshalom is the third son, and he's born to a woman named Maacha. And Tamar is going to be Avshalom's sister. Those are the three other children who are going to be, I don't want to call them victims, because they're going to play a role in what's going to happen, but they are going to be a result of what happened with David and Bathsheba. So the Navi writes, and it was afterwards. Clearly the Navi is connecting what happens in this chapter to what happened in the previous chapter. And it was afterwards. Ulav Shalom ben David achos yafa ushma tamar. Avshalom, the son of David, who we already know about because back in the second chapter of Shmuel Beis, these boys were listed, but Tamar has not been listed yet. So Avshalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister, and her name was Tamar. Amnon ben David. Amnon, the son of David, loved her. He was, as we'll see, he became love sick over her. And it was painful for Amnon until he became sick. Ba'avur Tamar achoso, on behalf of Tamar, his sister. Ki besulahi, for she was a besula, she had never been married. Vayipale beine Amnon, and it was distant in the eyes of Amnon, lasos la mu'uma, to do anything to her. He couldn't find a way to do anything to her. Now let's pause here and discuss the relationship between Amnon and Tamar. What was their relationship? Let's discuss the relationship of brothers and sisters in general in their day. And let us discuss what exactly is meant over here by saying that she was a besula, she'd never been married, and it was distant in his eyes to do anything to her. So first of all, what was the relationship between Amnon and Tamar? So Amnon and Avshalom are half-brothers. They share a father, David, but they come from different mothers. Amnon's mother is Ahinoam, and Avshalom's mother is Maacha. Tamar and Avshalom are sort of brother and sister. I mean, they are actually, it would appear that they are complete brother and sister. They share the same father, the same mother. However, Maacha was a Yefas Toar. Yefas Toar is that category of woman mentioned in the Torah that when we go out to war, and if a man, a Jewish man at war, comes across a woman, a non-Jewish woman, he is permitted to take her. And that is an explicit mitzvah in the Torah. He doesn't have to, of course, but he is permitted to take her in war. If he takes her in war, the following is the procedure that takes place. Before I describe the procedure, the Gemara says that the reason why the Torah permitted a Yefas Tohar is it was Dibra Kineged Yetzer Hara. The Torah speaks against the Yetzer Hara. Because at war, none of us, I don't believe any of us, thank God, have actually been at war, but when a person is at war, a person's physical body becomes very powerful. I don't mean powerful like strong, I mean physical, the physicality of one's body becomes very, very powerful, much more than the spiritual part of one's existence. When one is involved in a very, very physical activity, all physical desires, feelings become elevated. They become stronger. It is for this reason that the Torah itself, as the Gemara in Chulin explains, according to one opinion, permits when the Jews were conquering Eretz Yisrael for the first time, they were permitted to actually eat non-kosher food as they were conquering the land. Not because it was a question of life and death, when of course anybody can eat non-kosher food when it's a question of life and death, but because in battle, a person's physical desires become so powerful, the Torah gave a dispensation over there, according to one opinion. I'm only showing you that there is an understanding that when the physical body is used in a very intense way, all physicality becomes more intense. Therefore, in battle, it was a well known method of trying to defeat the enemy by having women, girls, try to entice the enemy. It was a very common practice, and it was a very effective practice, because in war, that's what happens. The physicality is brought out so much that the men become easy targets in that way. And therefore, the Torah specifically addresses this problem. And the way the Torah addresses this problem is rather than saying that you're not allowed, which would of course be the default, instead the Torah says, you are allowed, but there's a whole bunch of rules that come with it. So the Torah permits it, but in a limited manner. So what does the Torah permit? The Torah permits that a Jewish man in battle and comes across the enemy with a woman who is attempting to entice him, he is permitted to take her, and he is permitted to be intimate with her one time, that he is permitted to do. After that, he is not allowed to do anything more with her until he brings her back to his home. She goes through a process of mourning over her parents because now she's lost her previous life. She's been taken as a captive, as a prisoner of war, and she mourns over her family, her parents. The Torah describes that she lets her fingernails grow long. She goes through a period of time where she becomes ugly. In battle, she beautified herself. Here she becomes ugly. And at the end of that process of her mourning and allowing herself to become ugly, if he still wants to keep her, she converts, and then he may marry her. But then the marriage is a regular Jewish marriage. That's the process of Yefas Tohar. The Yefas Tohar, this woman who was put through this process in battle, it did happen in when we were at war frequently, it did happen. And Ma'acha, Avshalom's mother, was taken by David as a Yefas Tohar. In battle, she was taken as a Yefas Tohar. Now, the first time that the soldier is intimate with this woman, she is still not Jewish. Therefore, if she has a child, she conceives from that act, the child is not Jewish and needs conversion. So, in the case of Tamar and Avshalom, Tamar was conceived immediately. And therefore, Tamar was not technically born Jewish. Even if her mother converted before she was born, which is likely the case, she is not halachically related to her father, David. She's biologically related, as all converts are biologically related to their parents. But halachically, legally, there is no relationship. As you probably know, in theory, a brother and sister who convert could legally marry each other. Now, rabbinically, they can't. But there is a but legally, we have to know that from the Torah, once somebody converts, they are no longer related to their biological relatives. If a woman conceives and then converts and then gives birth, so the child is related biologically and halakhically to its mother, but not to its father. Doesn't matter who the father was. So Tamar is technically not related to David, meaning legally not related to David. Therefore, she is also legally, technically, not related to any of the children of David's other wives. And therefore, Amnon and Tamar are halakhically permitted to marry each other. They are not halakhically brother and sister. Avshalom and Tamar are related through their mother, because they both share the same mother. But even though biologically they're related to their father, halakhically they're not. Because Tamar was conceived prior to her mother's conversion. Avshalom was conceived after his mother's conversion. And so, if you're going to break it down now, let's talk biologically first. Biologically, Tamar and Avshalom are full siblings. Tamar and Amnon are half siblings. That's biologically. Halachically, Tamar and Avshalom are half siblings. Tamar and Amnon are not related. And we will see that later on explicitly, that Tamar is going to say to Amnon, I am permitted to you. Halachically, I am permitted to you. As we will see later on. Yeah.
Does this mean that in today's world, if a woman converts, it must be ascertained first that she's not pregnant?
We do require a separation after a woman converts. If a couple converts, halakhically they are required to separate for 3 months to make sure to see whether there is any whether she has conceived prior to the conversion.
And if she has, then the child that's born must be converted as well?
No, because then he's born to a woman who has converted previously. But he would not be related halakhically to the father. The conception is prior to conversion, but the birth is after conversion.
But what about the Jewish status of the child? The
child is Jewish.
So why in this case, if the Yefas Tohar is pregnant at the time of conversion, is that child then when born Jewish?
Yes.
It's just not related to the father?
Correct.
Halakhically.
Correct. Correct. I said it a little bit. I wasn't so clear before.
Okay. So yeah. There's three different things. There's biological relatedness, halakhic relatedness, and Jewishness.
Yeah. Right.
That are all going on. Yeah. And if an unmarried Jewish woman converts, is there any attempt made to ascertain if she's pregnant or not, or what? Like.
You mean if she's single and she converts?
Yeah.
Well, we would still require 3 months before she can marry, to make sure that she is not pregnant.
Okay.
I mean, if she is saying it's fine, we just have to know the status of the child. It's not a judgment. It's okay if she's pregnant. We just have to know what the status of the child is.
So she she's enjoined from having any relations for 3 months after
right.
conversion.
Right.
Any woman.
Right. Right. Any woman. Now, there are exceptions made if a woman is older and can't conceive, you know, that kind of
right.
thing. There are exceptions, but that's the default
okay.
halacha.
Okay.
Rabbi, these enticed women are married or not married. They can be taken either way.
Right. I mean, married before they were taken. Yeah. They can be taken even if they're married. Now, if in the end the soldier does not want to marry her, he has to let her go free. He can't sell her. He can't work her. He has to let her go home. He can't keep her unless he decides to marry her. Yeah.
I have two questions. One is, I know that Tamar was a girl, but let's say it had been a boy baby. So they would not have been from the tribe of Yehuda then.
Correct.
Not related to
that.
That
is correct.
They would have just been a Yisrael.
Jewish, but as if they converted without any tribe.
Okay.
Right.
And this enticed. What happens if a soldier takes an enticed woman and then decides not to take her home? Can he do that? Or once he's intimate.
Oh, does he have to take her home? I don't know. That's a good question. I imagine he can let her go. I don't think he has to take her home. That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know the rule for that.
Prevalent problem back then, sort of? It was happened very often?
I don't know how often it happened, but it did happen. It did happen. I mean, the Torah permits it. It is a permitted rule in the Torah. So the Torah permits it. And the reason why the Torah permits it is because of the problem, but the Torah does permit it. And it did happen.
Let me see if I understand. So after a woman converts, she's not Jewish, she converts, so she has to wait 3 months to be intimate?
Right. Because we need to see whether she was already pregnant prior to conversion. Because if she would be intimate right away, we wouldn't know that was the child conceived prior to or after conversion.
But all the conversions follow that.
That's the default. So as I said, there are some exceptions, but that's the default. You assume that unless there's a reason why not.
But he's already been intimate with her one time.
Which
could have created a pregnancy.
It could have.
And,
could have.
And when the woman, let's say the man doesn't want to keep her, is he responsible to bring her back to her?
It says he has to let her go. I don't know exactly what the financial arrangements are or whatever it is.
But he's not responsible for the child that he could have created. Because he's not...
You mean, what if is he allowed to let her go if she's... I don't know. I don't remember.
He said he doesn't want her, he can set her free, but...
Yeah, I don't know. The way the Torah describes it, it isn't discussing this eventuality that she became pregnant from the first intimacy. I don't know how often it happened, and then how often that happened. You know, it happened here. So, and he did marry her. So, I don't know. You're asking what if he didn't want to marry? I don't know.
Do we know what wife she was? Like, was it at the beginning when he was?
We had it already before. She was the third wife.
Okay.
Meaning, the first one was Amnon's mother, Achinoam. The second one was Abigail, which we learned about, and Ma'achal here is the third one.
What
is
his first wife
was
in
Michal? What's that? Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. You're correct. I forgot about Michal. You're right. I'm talking about after Michal.
Were those children looked upon in a special category, like an Erev Rav, in all the other times? But, I mean, did people actually want to marry the children of that relationship, even though they were converted?
Well, do you mean...
They considered full Jews, I suppose.
Well, I mean, the one... Are you talking about a woman who converts...
Yeah.
A woman who is already pregnant and converts?
No, I'm talking about children.
I mean, he was a prince.
In
he was.
You wouldn't marry them if you wanted a pure strain.
It was a regular convert. I mean, it's like marrying a convert. David married a convert. Mm-hmm. You know, Malach was a Gioris, a convert. Okay.
So,
yeah.
Tamar was then beautiful because of her mother. Did it say that?
It doesn't say why she was beautiful. I mean, it just says she was beautiful.
Well, Avshalom was supposed to be there.
Avshalom was also very, yeah, he's, as we'll see later. Yeah, he was very beautiful. Okay, now we have, that is the relationship between Tamar and Amnon. So they are technically not related, although biologically they do share a father. The relationship between brothers and sisters at this time in history is different than what we are all used to. And that is because this time in history precedes the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men of the Great Assembly, who lived in the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, the second Temple era. Of course, this time that we're learning about is prior to even the first Beis HaMikdash, the first Temple era. So this is several hundred years before the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly. What's significant about the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah? Because when the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, came along, we've talked about this before, they ascertained that the drive for Avodah Zarah, for idolatry, was becoming too difficult to resist. And as a result, too many people were being trapped in the sin of idolatry. And as you know, idolatry would be one of the worst sins one could possibly commit. And too many people were falling into that trap. It was too difficult to resist. And therefore, they davened that Hashem remove the drive for idolatry. And Hashem did. After their prayer, Hashem did. And that is why today we don't naturally have a drive for idolatry. We've described this before, that the Gemara says that if we would have the drive for idolatry, we would lift up our cloak and run to the nearest altar to slaughter an animal and offer it to idols. We wouldn't be able to resist. It would be such a powerful drive to do that. We look at it as a primitive thing to do. It's only primitive because we don't have the drive within us. But if we would have the drive within us like they did, we would run to do it. It would be exciting. It would be something we couldn't resist, or very, very difficult to resist. But the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah took care of that problem for us. They took away the drive for Avodah Zarah. When that happened, they said, okay, so we have removed the drive for Avodah Zarah, and it worked. Then let's tackle the next greatest problem, and that is the drive for immorality. And let us remove that as well. And they davened, and that too was removed. Immorality was removed. People no longer had a desire for relationships that are prohibited. The problem is that when they did that, they realized that the drive for any relationship was removed. You can't have one without the other. Either a person has a drive for physical relationships or doesn't. And therefore, after that happened, 3 days later, they checked and they couldn't even find eggs that had been laid by chickens. Chickens stopped laying eggs because there was no interaction between any male and female on the planet. So they realized that that's not going to work. So they had to, therefore, daven that it come back, which it did. But the Gemara says, what should we do? They said, what should we do? We would like to remove the drive to do sins and not remove the drive to have a physical relationship in a permitted manner. But we can't do that. You can't have one. It doesn't work that way. God doesn't split it up that way. So the Gemara says they did succeed in blinding the eye of the Yetzer Hara. What does that mean? Blinding the eye. I don't know exactly what it means, but the Gemara says that as a result of that episode, although the drive for physical relationships is alive and well, as we all know, and there's the immorality that goes on is rampant, and it's a $1 billion industry, but they did succeed in blunting it a little bit. They succeeded in removing some element of this drive. And the Gemara says that prior to the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, there was a drive for familial physical relationships, incest. There was a drive for incest. Rav Moshe Feinstein explains, never between parents and children. That, even for the creation of the world, there was never a drive like that. But between brothers and sisters, there was a drive, there was a desire, and after the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, that drive was removed. So today, brothers and sisters, under normal circumstances, under healthy normal circumstances, wouldn't dream of engaging in a physical relationship. most of the time, most brothers and sisters will speak with great disdain about any suggestion like that. But prior to the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, and the time of David HaMelech was prior to the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, it was not uncommon for a brother and sister to have a drive that was prohibited, a desire for each other, which was prohibited to act upon, because it's incest. So that a brother should have an interest in a sister was not impossible, was not crazy in their day. Now, it's prohibited. Obviously, when you're raising children, and you're raising boys and girls, knowing that they do have some element of interest in each other, as parents, you raise them in an appropriate manner to keep them separated. Whatever you have to do, after they reach a certain age, you make sure that there's appropriate boundaries. Today, we don't have the same issues, not to the same extent as they did there, because the drive isn't prevalent today. So it's not as big a problem. Even so, we still place boundaries. Most families should put boys and girls in separate rooms after they reach a certain age. But there is much less of an issue today. Even in our sick world, it's still much less of an issue today than it was in their day. In their day, when you raised siblings of different genders, you had to take that into account. Not to the same extent as people who weren't related to each other, but there was an element that you had to be careful about. So in David HaMelech's day, it would not have been strange for a brother to become lovesick over a sister. It could happen. And here, Amnon becomes sick with love over his sister. And again, halakhically she's not his sister, biologically she's a half-sister through their father. So that is what happens over here. Now, one last point before we move on is that the Navi says that it appears to say that the reason why he was lovesick over her is before she was a besula, for she had never been married. The commentaries don't understand it that way. They understand that because she was a besula, she had never been married, she was also very modest, because it was commonplace that the girls who were not yet married would stay away from men. They would be careful to stay away from men, and therefore Amnon could not find a way of getting to her. Then that's what it means. Because of the fact that she was a besula, meaning she was very modest, therefore, the next rest of the verse says, "Vayipale bein Amnon." It was distanced from Amnon. He couldn't get to her, lasos lama uma, to do anything to her. He did not know of a way of getting to her. So he had this terrible drive. It made him sick, and he didn't know what to do about it. He couldn't act upon it, and he couldn't get to her at all. So the Navi continues, pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Amnon had a friend, Ushmo Yonadav, and his name was Yonadav ben Shima Achi David. Yonadav was the son of Shima, the brother of David, which makes Yonadav and Amnon first cousins. Their fathers were brothers. David and Shima are brothers. David's son is Amnon, Shima's son is Yonadav. They are first cousins. Yonadav ish chacham ma'od. Yonadav was a very wise man. Our sages tell us, very wise for evil. He was not a good person. the Gemara also says, the Medrash says that you have to be careful what kind of friends you pick. And in giving examples of bad choices with friends, it mentions this case here of Amnon and Yonadav. Vayomalo Yonadav said to Amnon, Madua ata kacha dal ben hamelech, baboker baboker. Why are you like this? So weak, the son of the king, the prince, every morning. How come every morning I see you? You look very weak. Hello, Tangi Lee, please tell me. Vayomar lo Amnon. Amnon said to him, Es Tamar achos Avshalom achi ani ohev. Tamar, the sister of Avshalom, my brother, I love. Vayomar lo Yehonadav. Yehonadav said to him, Shchav al mishkavcha v'hiskol. Lie on your bed and be sick. In other words, Don't hide the fact that you're sick. Lie in bed and be sick. He didn't have to fake it. He was sick. Uba avicha lirosecha, your father will come to see you. V'amartai lav, you shall say to him, Tavona tamar achosi v'savreini lechem. Let Tamar, my sister, come and feed me bread, meaning make me a meal. She should make the meal in front of me, so that I will see, and I'll eat from her hand. So let Tamar, my sister, come and take care of me. And he says specifically, let her prepare the meal in front of me so I can see her, and let her feed me directly. Vayishkav, that was Yehonadav's advice to Amnon. Now, we are going to understand how this is supposed to work. Meaning, Yehonadav apparently is coming up with an idea that Amnon wouldn't have thought of himself. This took a very wise person to think of. So the question would be, what is so wise about this suggestion? David is going to go along with this, and is not apparently not going to realize what is going to happen. So that shouldn't be shocking to us, because if Yehonadav, who is very wise, came up with a plan, it must be a plan that has a strong chance of working. But
shrewd
is a good way to put it, yes. But he's clever and shrewd, and therefore the plan does work. It's just when you read it, it's hard to understand why does David not see it for what it is. Okay. Pasuk Vav, verse 6.
Can I ask a question? What would be Nadav's motivation in trying to make this happen?
Okay, that's a good question. It appears, at least at this point, it's purely to help his friend.
So can't be. No. He must know how evil this thing.
Okay, we're going to see at the end of the story that Yehonadav is going to come out looking good, but it's hard to think that he really anticipated all that's going to happen. He must have anticipated the actual plan itself, but as things spiral out of control, he's going to seize the opportunity and look very good. But it's hard to believe that he actually anticipated every single step of what's going to happen. But we got to see. We got to let it develop. You probably have already guessed that this is going to take at least 2 weeks. And we're not going to get this all done tonight. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Vayishkav Amnon, vayiskal Amnon, lay down, and he was sick. Vayavo hamelech liroso, the king came to see him, just as Yehonadav predicted. Vayomer Amnon el hamelech, so Amnon said to the king, following Yehonadav's instructions, Tavo na tamar achosi, let tamar my sister come, usalabev la'inai shte levivos, let her cook or bake or form in front of my eyes two loaves, ve'evrem yadah, let me be fed from her hand. Vayishlach David al tamar habaisa lemar, David sent to Tamar to the house. The Navi emphasizes, where was Tamar? She was in the house, because she was a very modest woman. So David sends to Tamar to the house, Lamar saying, L'china beis Amnon achich, go please, or go now, to the house of Amnon your brother, v'asilo habirya, and make for him the meal. So David follows the request of Amnon, just like Yehonadav predicted that David would. Just goes right along with it.
I've never heard of a princess cooking. So, I'm baffled by it.
Good. That's a good question as well. That's a good question.
They don't cook. That's a good servant to cook. It would really be insulting.
Good. Good.
Tell a princess, go prepare cake.
Okay. Good. Good.
So I'm lost.
Of course, it also depends who you're preparing it for, right?
No, princesses didn't prepare cake for anyone.
Okay. You know. Those things online to me too. I agree. And yeah. Why would anybody go along with sending a very modest, you know, young woman into some man's bedroom, even if
it wasn't.
He's not halakhically her brother.
Good.
I mean, David knew that.
Is it more reason
right?
not to?
Yeah, yeah.
Not
more
reason
good.
Not to.
No,
I mean, a servant girl would be
more likely.
Yeah, very. Yeah,
yeah.
I get that.
Yeah, right.
Okay. What am I missing?
There's a lot we got to talk about. So let's see the story develop. Vatelech Tamar beis Amnon achiha. So Amnon Tamar went to the house of Amnon her brother, v'hu shochev. and he was lying down. Now, there are other people there. They are not alone. There are other people in the house and in the room. She took the dough, and she kneaded it. And she, now, vatila bev means, the way Rashi explains it, she boiled it in front of him. What she did, she made a very special type of bread in which she first boiled it in water, and then she cooked the loaves, which, as Rashi explains, the Gemara says, she fried them in oil. First, she boiled the loaves, then she fried them in oil. This is a real pachka. This wasn't like a, you know...
That's in the way how you make a bagel.
Right.
Well, bagels are boiled and then baked. This was not boiled and baked. This is boiled and then fried.
Donuts. Sufganiyot.
Sufganiyot. Right. We're talking about something which is a specialty, which apparently, first of all, indicates that Tamar knew how to do this. Mm-hmm. She didn't. This wasn't the first time she picked up a... a cookbook, right? She, right? But also, it was a specialty thing. And the Gemara makes a point to tell us that this is what it was, which means the Gemara is deriving it from here, which means the Navi feels it's important for us to know. She didn't. It could have just said, Tamar baked bread and brought it to him. But that's not what it says. It says that Tamar boiled the dough and fried it in oil. And that's how she prepared it.
Sarah also, somebody else went to fetch her calf, and then she,
when
she told her to go in there and bake bread,
it's
paid
yeah,
time.
Yeah, but Sarah was her own home. It was her kitchen.
So you're thinking this is not her own.
She's at somebody else. She's at her brother's house, right?
She must have wanted this.
It appears like it. I mean, it looks like no one's suspecting anything over here. David sends her, and she seems to go willingly. Without any, you know, there doesn't seem to be any inkling of what's about to happen.
Wasn't it a way of life? I mean, you said this happened.
Okay.
A lot.
Okay. Well, let's.
It wasn't unusual. Was Tamar and Avshalom's mother, wasn't she of royalty too?
Yeah. Yeah.
So she comes from royalty. She didn't learn how to cook from her mom.
Okay. Okay.
I'm still on the royalty cooking.
Okay.
I'm
okay.
There.
All right.
Sarah was not royalty.
No. Not
so
not until later.
The fact
right.
that she cooked on her own was
yeah,
okay
yeah.
to me. But royalty
anyway.
Cooking, I'm.
Okay.
You know where I am cooking. Where I am with this cooking, you're amazed that it's royalty. You know what I think is significant about this cooking is that this takes two steps and a lot of work, and it involves building fires and boiling water and heating up oil in a pan. All this stretches out the length of time
Schlepping.
That she's in front
That's
of
this right.
young man. This is a very big, long production.
Right.
And he's got a whole lot of time to have conversations with her. And
right.
Her and
right.
All that,
okay.
You know?
Okay. I mean, it's all happening. Now, Batikach es hamasreis. She took the frying pan. Masreis is the frying pan, the pan. Batitzok lefanav. And she poured it before him. Meaning, she poured out those sufganiyot for him to eat. Vayimo ein leachol, he refused to eat. Vayomer Amnon and Amnon said, Hotziu chol ish me'alai, remove all men from before me, everybody should leave. Vayetzu chol ish me'alav, and everybody left. Vayomer Amnon el Tamar, Amnon said to Tamar, Havi habirya hacheder, bring the meal to the room. Apparently there were two rooms, it wasn't just one room. So bring it to the inner room. Ve'evrem yadech, and I will be fed from your hand. Again, there is no suspicion over here. Vatigach Tamar es halevivot asher asata. Tamar took the loaves that she made. Vatavei la'amnon achiha hechadron. She brought it to Amnon, her brother, to the room. Vatagei she'lov la'achol. She brought it close to him to eat. Vayachaz ekba. He grabbed hold of her. Vayomer la, and he said to her, notice the words, Boi shichvi imi achosi. Come and lie with me. My sister. Those are the words. So, when he says that, apparently, there is at least, in his mind, a possibility that she would acquiesce. If he didn't think that she would acquiesce, he doesn't have to say anything. Just molest her, which is what he's going to do. But instead he first says these words, which indicates that he at least has in his mind a possibility that she would be willing. Vatomer lo, she said to him, Al achi, don't my brother, Al ti'aneni, do not molest me. Ki lo yayasechein b'Yisrael, for this is not done in Yisrael. We don't do this. Al ta'aseh ta'nevola hazos, do not do this despicable thing. Va'ani ana oli chesher fasi, and I, where will I take my shame? Ve'ata, and you, tia kachara nevola b'Yisrael, you'll be one of the despicable people amongst Israel. If you do this, where will I go with my shame? And you're going to be thought of as a disgusting person. Now, speak to the king. He won't hold me back from you. I'm permitted to you. If you want to marry me, the king will let us marry. Just speak to him. He's not going to say no. We are halachically permitted. He did not want to listen to her. Vayechazak mimena, he was stronger than her. Vayeaneha, and he molested her. Vayishkav osa, and he lied with her, laid with her. Now, vayisnoeha Amnon sino gedola maod, and Amnon hated her a great hatred. Ki gedola hasina asher sneya, for the hatred that he hated her was greater me'ahava asher ahiva, from the love that he had loved her. He now hated her more than he had loved her. Vayarmala Amnon kumi lechi, Amnon said to her, get up and get out. Now, lest you think that Amnon's hatred is purely because he got what he wanted and now he's has no need for her. But the Gemara tells us it's more than that. The Gemara tells us that in the process, she managed to permanently hurt him. So in the process, she managed to permanently hurt him in a way that forever after, intimacy would be a difficult process for him. So it's not quite mutilation, but she definitely... definitely hurt him.
Doesn't it speak you're not allowed to do that to a man? That's where it's in the
I'm saying
to hurt him physically when he
it does say in the Torah that if two men are fighting and one of the wives steps forward to help her husband and she right. So the guy says you have to pay for that. It's damages. But here it was self defense. She was being attacked.
Good for her. Yeah, I think we're all really
Okay. No, I mean, I don't think anybody feels bad for Amnon. No. But no. I'm just pointing out to you, the hatred wasn't simply because now he's disposing of her. He hates her because he really got hurt. So he's now permanently maimed. Vatomer lo, and she said to him, "Ow, don't." Odos hara'a hagdola hazos, because of this great evil, me'acheres asher asisa imi, more than the other one that you did to me, l'shalcheini. What you're going to do now is worse than what you just did. What you did, you molested me, that's bad enough. Now you're going to throw me out? That's even worse. Don't do that. The commentaries say, because we know the rule is, that if a man does, God forbid, molest a woman, then unless she isn't interested, he's required to marry her and not allowed to divorce her. Now, she may not be interested, but it's her choice, not his. And here, he's throwing her out. So she says, this is even worse. V'lo ava lishmo ala, he didn't want to listen to her. Vayikra es naro misharso, and he called his lad, the one who served him. Vayomer, and he said, Shilchuna es zos me alai, send this one from before me, hachutz outside. Get this thing out of here. Una ol hadelas achareha, and lock the door behind her. Ve'aleha ksones pasim, and on her, she used to wear a ksones pasim. What is a ksones pasim?
Like
Yosef. A colorful tunic.
For
for it was common for the daughters of the king to wear fancy jackets. Vayotzeo sam misharso hachutz, his servant took her outside, threw her outside, v'nor adel sachareha, and locked the door behind her. Vatikach tamar eifel arosha, tamar put ashes on her head. Uchsonet hapasim ashaleha kira'a, kara'a, and the ksonet pasim, this beautiful cloak of his honor, she tore. Vatasem yada arosha, she put her hand on her head, vatelech haloch v'za'aka, and she went and she around and she screamed. Just walked around wailing. That's what she did. The Gemara tells us that Tamar here affected a powerful improvement in Klal Yisrael, amongst the Jewish people. By doing this, by walking around and wailing, she got a lot of people to recognize the dangers of getting too close, of being in a situation where it's too close to a man in this situation. I'll explain to you in a moment what happened. But before that, let's just read the next pasuk. Vayomer eleha Avshalom achiha. Avshalom, her brother, said to her, Ha'aminon achich haya imach. Was Aminon. Aminon is a disparaging way of saying the word Amnon. He's like making fun of Amnon's name. Was Aminon your brother? Was he with you? Ve'atai now achosi, my sister hacharishi, be silent. Achichu, he is your brother. Al tashisi et libech la'davar hazad, do not put your heart to this matter. In other words, it happened. What happened, happened. You can't change it. Vateshev Tamar v'shomema, Tamar sat or dwelled and she was silent, she was subdued. Beis Avshalom Achia, the house of Avshalom, her brother. Avshalom took her in and she stayed there. Now Avshalom is, let's go a little further. V'hamelech David shama iskol advarim ma'ilet, the King David heard all these things, v'yichalamod, he was very upset. V'lo diber Avshalom im Amnon l'meira v'ad tov. Avshalom did not speak to Amnon from bad to good. He didn't say anything to Amnon. Ki sane Avshalom es Amnon, for Avshalom hated, despised Amnon. Al devar asher ina es Tamar achoso, for he had molested Tamar, his sister. We're going to stop here for now. The balance of this parak, of this chapter, is going to be how Avshalom plots and eventually is successful in taking revenge and killing Amnon. That is what he's going to do. It's going to take 2 years, but eventually Avshalom will finally get Amnon in a vulnerable place, and he will kill him to take revenge for what Amnon did to his sister. Now, the Gemara tells us that we know that there is a mitzvah in the Torah called Yichud. Yichud means seclusion. We know that a married woman is not allowed to be in seclusion with a man who is not related to her. There are various details about this rule, but we know it is a rule in the Torah. That rule applies to a married woman. A single woman is not the prohibition for a single woman to be intimate with a man out of wedlock. It is prohibited, but it is not nearly the same level of prohibition as adultery. A married woman. A married woman, should she have an intimate relationship with a man other than her husband, so that is, if they were warned properly and there are witnesses, then both would be put to death. It's a capital crime. Whereas a single woman who has an intimate relationship with a man out of wedlock, it is prohibited, it is not punishable by death. It is not nearly as severe. The Torah's prohibition of yichud, of seclusion, is only a married woman. Because there, should she be intimate with another man, it is a terrible, terrible sin. For a single woman, the Torah does not prohibit yichud, seclusion. It does prohibit intimacy out of wedlock, but does not prohibit seclusion. The sages rabbinically prohibited yichud, seclusion, for a single woman. When did the sages do this? Right here. After the story of Tamar and Amnon became known, then David and his beis din, David's court, enacted the rule that yichud, that seclusion, applies across the board, not only to married women, but also to a single woman. That was as a direct result of this story. Yichud, seclusion, was expanded to include everybody, not only a married woman.
From what age is that?
What age for a girl? 3 years old.
Oh, yeah.
3 years old.
And a man?
A man would be 9 years old. Now, you have to have, one of the two parties has to be over bar or bas mitzvah, because there are no rules that apply. If you have a 9-year-old boy and a 3-year-old girl, that you can't, neither one of them is liable. So neither one can be spoken to in that way. But if you have a 12-year-old girl and a 9-year-old boy, the rule applies. If you have a 13-year-old boy and a 3-year-old girl, the rule applies. Yeah. Now, it does come up with babysitting. It is something that people have to take into account when they get babysitters. You have to realize what the rules are and when it applies, when it doesn't apply. There are some issues with that.
I'm stuck back when he called the servant. The servant came to, get rid of Tamar. When Tamar yelled out, when the
servant
come?
It seems that in the back room she couldn't be heard. That's what it seems. I don't know for certain. But nobody came to save her, so apparently it wasn't.
Or even when he screamed, because when she's maiming him, I'm assuming he screamed.
Yeah, I assume something happened. But, it's the prince. I don't know. Who knows? Anyway, just 1 second. So when Tamar went around wailing and put her hand on her head and she tore her tunic and she had ashes on her head, what they did is it publicized what happened. Mm-hmm. It could have been hush-hush.
Mm-hmm.
But instead it became a public matter. And the Gemara says, as a result of what she did, the women in Yerushalayim who found out about this, they said, if this could happen to a princess, of course it could happen to a common lady. And if this could happen to a woman who was as great a tsanua, who was as modest as Tamar, who was a paradigm of modesty, then a woman who doesn't have that level of modesty, all the more so it could happen. So she took her predicament and used it to raise awareness of this issue, of the problem, of the danger of being in a position where this sort of thing can happen. And as a result of what she did, many women improved their tzniut, their modesty. They realized that they needed to be more careful. And David beis din enacted the rule of yichud. That was Tamar's contribution to the Jewish people as a result of what happened to her, which is remarkable that Tamar could react that quickly to what happened. In other words, here you have a woman who her whole future has been destroyed. I mean, she's literally been destroyed. Her life is now in shambles. She'll have to somehow fix it up. But she's literally, I mean, any hopes and dreams she had are for sure dashed. And not only that, but even the Torah's backup plan, which is that the man who molested her has to take her in, he threw her out. So he's not willing to keep the rule of the Torah. So now she's really stuck. Like, what's going to happen now? So without taking time out to sit and think and brood and just get over her anger, and instead, she immediately realizes that if this happens to me, I need to make sure it doesn't happen to anybody else. Which is a common reaction when a person goes through a tragedy, but usually it takes time before the person can recover and then say, okay, what can I do for society? Here, she right away turns around and makes it into something that will help other people, which is a remarkable thing about Tamar. But at any rate, she eventually is taken in by Avshalom, and then Avshalom, as we said, is going to plot and eventually be successful to take revenge for what happened to his sister. You have a question? No.
Are we? Yeah, I did. Are we to take what the Gemara says about her harming Amnon as being oral Torah? I mean, as oral Torah, you know, Torah Shabbat. Are we to take that as true, or is that just?
Yeah. No, they're right. They pick it out of the Pesukim over here.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just trying to be selective about how much detail to throw in. I mean, the Gemara says how she named him.
Really?
Yeah. The Gemara says how it happened. It's not in any manner that you would think of. It's completely beyond the realm of anything you would consider right now. It was a more common problem in their day, but it becomes very, very specific, and I'm just not comfortable going there.
Yeah.
I don't think we have to.
No.
So I'd rather not go down that road.
You accomplished quite a lot.
The Gemara also is very specific about what exactly happened with the molestation. And the whole act is picked apart. But unless we have to go down that road, I'm going to avoid it.
So are you saying that would be Torah Shabbat there, that all the details?
Yeah, it's all there. It's all there in the Gemara. It's all there. Great detail.
I don't understand why a woman would have to go back to him. She has free choice not to
go back. Yeah, but she wants to.
Why?
You can ask that question, but she wants to. She's asking to stay. He threw her out.
Well, because she wants to hide the shame of the thing.
Could be. Could be. Could be.
Anybody want to go?
She wants to. Here's an example.
How about the other woman?
If she does, I imagine other women would want to also. I don't know. I can't.
She's not obligated. She
but she wants
to leave.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
But he has no choice to throw her out.
It says the passage that David was upset when he found out, and then it drops it.
Right.
Like, it doesn't seem like he does anything.
Right. Well, what he does is he enacts the thing of Yuchud. The question is, what does he do about his? What does he do about his children? That's the
right.
question.
Right.
What does he do with Amnon? What does he do with Tamar? That's the question. The biggest enigma of the whole thing. There's a lot of issues that we're going to have to cover over here. We're going to have to cover what was Amnon thinking that maybe Tamar would be willing. What was Yonadav's great, incredible wisdom over here, this cleverness, what was this great plan? But one of the things that's really difficult is to understand what is David thinking. What was David thinking the whole time when the plan was hatched? What was he thinking? He sent her, and how does it play out? I'm going to give you one insight to start off with, but we have to continue next week. And that is, David knows that he's going to pay for what happened with Bathsheba four times. He was already told there's going to be a four different things are going to happen to him. The first one happened already. The child died. He knows he's going to endure three more tragedies. He knows that. And what happens?
He doesn't stop it.
What happens? He gets word that Amnon is sick in bed. And he comes to visit him. What is David thinking? He's clearly thinking, Amnon is going to die. My firstborn, just like my other baby, died. Now Hashem is going to punish me that my firstborn is going to die. That is David's mindset when he goes to visit Amnon. Now that's very, very important. David's mindset is like that. Yonadav knew that David's mindset would be that way. He knew that we're dealing with a man who is going to come to visit his son and immediately jump to conclusions that he is on his deathbed. That is playing on somebody's weakness. He's exploiting where David is vulnerable. And Yonadav is going to play to that. And the plan that he's going to hatch is going to take advantage of this weakness. You see the what did you use?
Shrewdness.
See how shrewd he is. It's really mean what he's doing. He's taking a man who knows he's going to endure tragedy and has already lost a child, and here is expecting this to happen and make him believe that he's about to lose another one. And in that backdrop, he's able to make things happen.
And that's the question is, why wouldn't he, if he's so lovesick for her, why wouldn't he do it
Excellent.
Could have her.
Excellent. Especially since she says that to him.
Yeah.
She says, don't molest me. Right? She says, you want to marry me? Marry me.
Yeah.
Right? She says, and it sounds like she'll do it, too.
Yeah.
She's willing. She's not resisting that. She says, you want to marry me? Marry me. She's not saying, I won't marry you.
Exactly. So that's
also a good way of getting out of the current situation.
Could be. But he doesn't take her up on it.
Uh-huh.
Right? He thinks she might be willing. Mm-hmm. He thinks she might be willing to be intimate. So she could have, it sounds like she's saying, okay, so let's get married.
I think it's significant that earlier on it says that he's lovesick, but, she was far from him or removed or whatever, and so he could not do anything to her. I mean, that's really unusual language.
Mm-hmm.
It was not so he could not speak to her, so he could not
hear
her. No, it was
right.
It's put so that he could not
do anything
to her. That's
okay. So next week we're going to attempt to answer as many of these questions as we can. There's also the second half of the parak of the chapter, which probably we won't get to until the following week because we have so much to cover over here.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.